In the heart of Honduras, a young man named Roberto is laid to rest, his grave bearing the wrong death date, a small indignity for someone whose life was deemed disposable by society. Though media often portrays smugglers as predatory criminals, Roberto defied stereotypes. He wasn't a kingpin, but a skinny Honduran kid guiding others through terrain he knew intimately. His modest funeral, filled with wailing and prayers, represented countless others caught in the clandestine migration economy. Desperate people with nicknames like Kingston, Flaco, and Alma, whose real names often remain mysteries until inscribed on tombstones. This powerful account has become required reading in university courses on migration and border politics, with celebrities like America Ferrera and John Leguizamo praising its unflinching portrayal of the human cost of border enforcement. Through 7 years of immersive fieldwork, anthropologist Jason De Leon gained unprecedented access to smugglers' lives, offering a perspective rarely seen in migration literature. While politicians debate border security in abstract terms, De Leon's work forces us to confront the human reality behind the statistics, revealing how America's border policies have created the very smuggling networks they claim to fight. In a pristine Tegucigalpa restaurant, I sit among Honduras elite while outside lies a country ravaged by poverty, corruption, and violence. I'm here to interview members of GOET, Grupo de Operaciones Especiales Tácticas, a Honduran police force created during the Obama administration to prevent migration. Despite wearing Honduran flags, these agents receive significant American support and training. Their mission? Intercept unaccompanied minors and migrants without proper documentation. The GOET agents candidly acknowledge the desperation driving their fellow citizens to flee. Many migrants have told me they would prefer to die in El Camino than stay home and wait to die from gang violence or hunger, one agent admits. Honduras, the original banana republic, suffers from decades of U.S. intervention, government corruption, and extreme inequality, with nearly half the population living on less than $5.50 per day, a situation worsened by recent hurricanes and the pandemic. GOET represents just one piece of a larger U.S.-sponsored security network across Latin America. After thousands of unaccompanied Central American minors arrived at the U.S. border in 2014, the Obama administration pressured Mexico to create Programa Frontera Sur. Though officially designed to protect migrants' rights, this initiative primarily increased Mexican immigration checkpoints, raids, and deportations, essentially extending U.S. prevention through deterrence strategy while allowing America to avoid responsibility for human rights violations occurring on Mexican soil. I witnessed the brutality of Mexico's immigration enforcement when my friend Escobar, a low-level smuggler, is arrested. Despite being handcuffed and slammed against a van, Escobar defiantly tells the agent he'll return within days. The tall immigration agent with thick jowls warns me against hanging out with Hondurans and ignores my pleas. At a migrant shelter presentation, when this same agent suggests assault victims file reports with his office, a migrant boldly asks, "What if it was the police that robbed you?" triggering knowing laughter from the crowd. For decades, undocumented migration typically involved young Mexican men hiring local coyotes they could trust, small-scale operators from their home communities who would guide them to the U.S. for $3,500 to $7,500. This community-based accountability made the system relatively straightforward. If something went wrong, everyone knew whose door to knock on. In recent years, Central Americans have become the majority of border crossers, making migration more complex. Their longer journeys require crossing multiple countries and boundaries, costing thousands more. Unlike Mexicans with established networks in the U.S., Hondurans often flee gang violence with minimal planning and smaller support systems. After Programa Frontera Sur added security to train routes, riding La Bestia became much harder. Migrants now rely on guías, who are often gang members, fellow migrants, or drifters. Ironically, the same gangsters Central Americans were fleeing now offer guide services on the migrant trail. Pakal Na in Chiapas, Mexico, is described as a poem, a bloodletting, a roadside memorial, a wish, a central hub for migrants that constantly remakes itself in new outlines and shadows. I selected this location partly because of its proximity to tourist-friendly Palenque, while serving as an important migrant trail stop with a humanitarian shelter. In 2015, I began fieldwork there during the implementation of Programa Frontera Sur. While initially planning to interview migrants at the local shelter, curiosity led me to venture outside, where I encountered a group of young men smoking marijuana by the train tracks. After convincing them I wasn't police, but rather a chronicler of migrant stories, I began spending time with Chino, Santos, Papo, Alma, and their crew, connections that would eventually take me across Latin America and the U.S. researching smugglers. As one smuggler, Chino, told me, "Everyone says that we are all bad, but that's not true. It's just that no one ever listens to our stories." Daily life at the Pleasure Palace, a street corner gathering spot, reveals the complex social dynamics among migrants. Santos tattoos catracho, slang for Honduran, on Chino's arm, while others smoke marijuana, share stories, and observe nervous migrants heading to the shelter across the street. The atmosphere blends camaraderie with underlying tension, especially around less trusted figures like Bin Laden and the Breadman. The smuggling process begins with Zero, a mid-level smuggler who texts pickup locations and migrant counts to guides. The journey requires nearly 200 kilometers of walking through jungle and highways to evade immigration checkpoints and bandits. Along the way, migrants face numerous dangers, including armed encounters that can only be resolved through verification from higher-ups. Upon arrival in Pakal Na, migrants meet Payaso, the clown, an MS-13 enforcer with demon tattoos and eyes glassy and opaque like a dead fish, who ensures no one enters without paying. Behind him is Pato, who tracks all migrants in a ledger. The system is inescapable. Payaso has eyes everywhere, through a network of lookouts including children and the elderly. Migrants must pay $100 to $200 per person at six different checkpoints to avoid torture or mutilation. After this gauntlet, they'll pay another $3,000 to reach the Texas border, with three crossing attempts included before additional fees. The total journey costs around $7,000 with no guarantee of success. Meanwhile, the guides collect their modest $120 payment for a week's work, sending money home and buying beer for a celebration at the Pleasure Palace. From atop the freight train, the world appears infinite with possibility, a story yet to be written for young people seeking control in their lives, if only briefly. But how does someone become a migrant guide? Chino's story provides a window into this world. In their modest cinderblock home in Villanueva, Honduras, Chino's sister Marina reveals his troubled beginnings. His teenage mother Celia threatened to give him away when he was 6 months old, forcing his grandmother Luz to take him in despite already caring for six children. Growing up in extreme poverty with a dirt floor and no plumbing, Chino suffered from severe asthma and pneumonia that nearly killed him. Though his grandparents became his surrogate parents, he grew bitter about his drug-addicted mother's absence and never knowing his biological father. By 13, Chino had already witnessed unimaginable family tragedy. His grandmother Luz had lost four of her seven children, including Miguel, Chino's beloved older brother and father figure, who was electrocuted while cutting a tree near power lines. Miguel's death devastated the family. At his wake, 13-year-old Chino turned to guaro, potent sugarcane liquor, marijuana, and partying. His faith shattered. He told Marina, "There is no God, but there is a devil, and he is powerful. The devil is inside me." Unable to bear the claustrophobia of village life and proximity to his brother's grave, 14-year-old Chino moved to Dos Caminos on the outskirts of San Pedro Sula. Seeking a replacement for Miguel's guidance, Chino found it in his drug-abusing stepfather, who introduced him to armed robbery. the fast cash proved far more attractive than his previous $5-a-day construction work or his grandfather's grueling field labor. Gang life gave Chino a sense of power and protection. He learned to move undetected through neighboring colonias to mug strangers and began to excel at violence. The monster driving Central American migration is built from poverty, corruption, disenfranchisement, rage, a beast with many names, faces, and a never-ending arsenal of weapons. For many youth, gang involvement begins as exhilarating, offering money, drugs, and power to those who've never felt it before. But the thrill fades as they're forced to extort neighbors and terrorize children. They watch petty robberies and petty squabbles turn into petty murders until they can no longer face their neighbors. Eventually, Chino's violent past catches up with him when men attack him with machetes, leaving him scarred from shoulder to wrist. He flatlines in the ambulance, but miraculously survives. After weeks in a San Pedro Sula hospital, unable to pay his $650 bill, he escapes through a window. With nowhere safe to return to, he heads north, carrying both physical and emotional scars from his homeland. For 16-year-old Chino, Mexico becomes a dark playground of restlessness, freedom, and violence. The train tracks become his home as he traverses the country, learning to survive deportation and becoming a guide. He teaches crucial lessons: don't fall asleep sitting up on trains, speak like a Mexican to avoid deportation, and trust no one. People always disappear. When he finally returns home, he's transformed, dirty, tattooed, and consumed by rage and addiction. Though he could return to Honduras, he knows he'd either join the gangs or be killed by them. Among the young men gathered near the tracks is Jesmyn, a petite 20-year-old who seems out of place yet holds her own. Despite her pink heartbreaker t-shirt and quiet demeanor, her feline eyes coolly assess everyone around her. Unlike the scarred, tattooed men who talk too much, Jesmyn understands the value of listening and knowing when to speak. Her mix of coolness, boldness, and hyper-awareness marks her as someone who could join these smugglers if she chose. 5-year-old Jesmyn watches her mother, Ramona, wailing in the street over a dead body, a man she believed was her brother, but would later learn was her biological father, Oscar. At 10, Jesmyn discovers her parents are actually her grandparents, and her sister is her aunt. This complex kinship arrangement reflects how poverty forces families to adapt through non-traditional structures, providing stability amid violence and economic hardship. Oscar, like Chino, matured quickly on the rough streets of Llanos de Sula, but avoided direct gang affiliation to maintain freedom of movement. When Oscar reported a co-worker for stealing, his righteousness proved fatal. One day, while partying, the former co-worker stabbed him from behind. 5-year-old Jesmyn was brought to the crime scene, where she watched her grandmother kneeling on the gravel, pleading with God. Even before Oscar's death, Jesmyn had noticed the gang members roaming her neighborhood, simultaneously frightening and fascinating her. By age 8, their guns and manner of speaking both scared and excited her. At 13, Jesmyn became the object of obsession for a high-ranking gang member called Smiley, a man in his mid-20s who stalked her in his bulletproof vest and Nike Cortez shoes, guns tucked into his waistband. For 2 years, Smiley's obsession terrified Jesmyn. When she discovered him peering through her second-story window while she was undressing, Jesmyn finally told her mother everything. For her safety, she went into hiding, never venturing out alone for a year. Then Smiley was arrested, creating new fears he might send his soldiers after her. Ramona tearfully sent Jesmyn to live with her birth mother in a distant coastal town. After nearly a year in exile, news arrived that Smiley had been killed in a prison explosion. "God can liberate you from anything," her mother said. Finally free, Jesmyn packed her backpack and headed for the Guatemala border, dreaming of reaching the United States to support her parents. Santos carries drugs across the Sonoran Desert to cover his border crossing fees to Phoenix, unable to afford the $3,000 to $5,000 coyote payment otherwise. When a young Honduran in their group collapses from exhaustion, Santos intervenes as the guide threatens to kill the boy with a rusty knife. He's a catlacho, a paisa, Santos argues, refusing to abandon his countrymen despite the guide's threats. Later, another smuggler tells Santos he's too soft for guide work, which Santos acknowledges. In a small village east of San Pedro Sula, young Santos watches his father's burial after months of suffering. This early loss foreshadows his future hardships. By 16, Santos has survived years on Mexico's dangerous rail yards, begging and stealing to stay alive while experiencing brutal torture. After being tied to a chair and carved with parallel cuts by masked Zetas, he miraculously survives. Though given money to return to Honduras, Santos refuses to go back to poverty and teenage gangs. Instead, he uses the funds to continue north, eventually approaching the Mareros in Pacalna for work. With his expertise in clandestine movement, Santos becomes a guide for migrants, earning steady income delivering groups to Celaya. He eventually saves enough to head north himself, crossing into Arizona as a marijuana mule. In Phoenix, he finds peace in steady construction work and his own bed, until a traffic stop leads to deportation. Back in Honduras, his childhood friend Spider, now an MS-13 leader, gives him three options: join the gang, leave, or die. Santos chooses exile once again. Santos confesses the lifestyle is overwhelming him. He explains how the job of guiding migrants has become dangerous and unrewarding. If you don't pay the quota, they kill you. If you pay but don't get along with them, they may take your money and kill you anyway. Despite the daily struggle just to eat, he feels he's accomplishing nothing. When asked if others enjoy the lifestyle, Santos admits many do, but he can't handle it. "I don't feel anything noble about getting money from being a guide. The job is hard, and you never know the truth about what is happening. You never feel safe. I don't think I was born for this type of work." A violent scene unfolds as a young motorcyclist named Papo commits an act that will derail his entire life, leaving behind dust and death smoke. This moment becomes the catalyst for his troubled journey. Papo huddles with fellow migrants in freezing Texas, shocked by the cold that contradicts movie depictions of the state. His lanky frame offers no protection as they hide under plastic sheeting, listening anxiously for approaching vehicles. When Border Patrol discovers them, Papo's journey takes another turn. Separated from his mother at a young age, Papo grew up in La Ceiba, Honduras, surrounded by violence that followed him like some vicious and insatiable vine. When his mother finally arranged his passage to Texas 12 years later, he was detained but released due to his age. In Texas, Papo struggles through remedial English classes before abandoning school at 18 to work menial jobs, helping repay his mother's $7,000 smuggling debt. Though he considers himself lucky compared to childhood friends who are now dead, his fortune changes when a minor marijuana possession charge and a 15-minute tardiness to court result in deportation back to Honduras, back to the hole he thought he had escaped. Alma's story parallels Papo's abandonment. Her mother left her as a 4-month-old with an aunt, promising to return soon. Years passed and someday never comes. Though her aunt became the only mother she knew, Alma grew up with a profound sense of abandonment, her biological mother reduced to merely a voice from a faraway place where promises go to be broken. At the Pleasure Palace near the train tracks in Pacalna, Alma maintains her facade as a struggling migrant mother while actually working as an informant for MS-13. She collects information about newly arrived migrants that helps the gang determine who needs to pay the quota or whose family might be extorted. Many locals participate in this information network, both for extra cash and to protect themselves from gang retaliation. Alma and Papo are seeking temporary humanitarian visas from the Mexican government that would allow them to stay legally, travel freely, and access federal programs. Though these visas don't permit legal work, Alma hopes they'll help her daughters enter public school. Despite Papo's connection to MS-13, selling drugs and relaying information under duress in exchange for protection and free marijuana, they decide to be truthful about most aspects of their story. Papo explains he fled Honduras after being wrongfully targeted for a shooting committed by someone borrowing his motorcycle. For the first time, he shows vulnerability, breaking down in tears as he describes his constant fear. "I've been afraid in Honduras, in the United States, and in Mexico. I don't want to be afraid anymore." The train's whistle sounds in the distance as Flaco, Acid, Payaso, and their crew scramble to grab their belongings. They joke around, with Acid pretending to chase them, while Flaco puts his arm around him affectionately. Despite Acid's erratic behavior, like talking into a pack of Marlboros as if it were a phone, Flaco values having such unpredictable allies on the dangerous train routes. "You gotta have hermanos like that on the tracks," he explains. "It's always better to have some crazy motherfuckers with you. But I don't get messed with. My people never get robbed because I'm crazy and I'm connected." Flaco's life in California unfolds through a scene of him cruising in a Civic, Art LeBeau's oldies filling the air. When he spots someone who owes him money, he confronts him with a gun, pistol whips him, and rips off his gold chain. This altercation leads to his arrest. Facing charges of breaking and entering, assault with a deadly weapon, and armed robbery, the prosecutor pushes for 25 to life, leaving Flaco in tears. Years later, Flaco works as a coyote, spending lavishly on drugs, alcohol, and parties to maintain loyalty among his crew while they wait for a train. He photographs his four migrant clients to send ahead as receipts for the $200 quota he's paid to the Zetas. Despite his criminal past and deportation, Flaco boasts he could return to the U.S. easily, but prefers Mexico, where he claims to make thousands in just weeks. "I make more money now than I ever did there," he brags while sniffing cocaine. "I got three women now and three houses." His wild spending, $600 in a single day, keeps his drug-addicted foot soldiers loyal and numbs everyone to the constant dangers of their work. In a dingy, overcrowded safe house on Mexico City's outskirts, Andy, the 31-year-old den mother to young Honduran smugglers, cooks plantains while music blasts. Unlike his companions who have humanitarian visas, Andy lacks documentation after being denied for filing a complaint against an immigration official who assaulted him. He makes ends meet through charol, begging at stoplights, which Garifuna men can earn decent money doing, though they face discrimination. When Kingston enters the apartment, everyone straightens up like soldiers before a commanding officer. Kingston's prison-honed physique, American gang tattoos, and silver-capped teeth create an intimidating yet charismatic presence. He's a veteran Blood gang member who has risen from foot soldier to leader, commanding respect through his connections to high-ranking gang leaders in the U.S. After taking photos in the courtyard, Kingston confronts me directly. "You not police, right?" I explain my anthropological research, promising transparency and offering to walk away if trust can't be established. Kingston accepts my explanation and invites me to his house in Veracruz. Sitting in the apartment courtyard with beers between us, Kingston begins explaining the smuggling business. "They say that people getting ripped off at the frontera is the fault of guides, but I don't think that's the reason," he explains. "The business operates on recommendations. Guides who abandon migrants damage their reputations." Kingston details the payment structure: $1,000 upfront in Honduras, additional payments at various stages, with the guide making only $300 to $400 per person until reaching Mexico City. The real challenges occur at the northern border, where Mexican caminadores, walkers, subcontracted by cartels, take over. These third-party smugglers are often unpredictable in how they'll treat clients. When Kingston enters the apartment, everyone straightens up like soldiers before a commanding officer. Kingston's prison-honed physique, American gang tattoos, and silver-capped teeth create an intimidating yet charismatic presence. He's a veteran Blood gang member who has risen from foot soldier to leader, commanding respect through his connections to high-ranking gang leaders in the U.S. After taking photos in the courtyard, Kingston confronts me directly. You not police, right? I explain my anthropological research, promising transparency, and offering to walk away if trust can't be established. Kingston accepts my explanation and invites me to his house in Veracruz. Sitting in the apartment courtyard with beers between us, Kingston begins explaining the smuggling business. They say that people getting ripped off at the frontera is the fault of guides, but I don't think that's the reason, he explains. The business operates on recommendations. Guides who abandon migrants damage their reputations. Kingston details the payment structure. $1,000 upfront in Honduras, additional payments at various stages, with the guide making only $300 to $400 per person until reaching Mexico City. The real challenges occur at the northern border, where Mexican caminadores, walkers, subcontracted by cartels, take over. These third-party smugglers are often unpredictable in how they'll treat clients. Kingston's life story unfolds through painful memories and present-day reflections. As an 8-year-old, he endured brutal beatings from his mother, who would hang him upside down and whip him with electrical cords. Unable to endure the abuse, he fled home and began living on the streets, singing for money and washing buses. When his mother died of cancer when he was 12, Kingston was completely abandoned. Even relatives would pass him on the street without acknowledgement. Around age 12 or 13, Kingston was forcibly conscripted into the Honduran military during Reagan-era anti-communist operations. The military conducted manhunts in poor neighborhoods, taking Kingston and several gang associates to serve. As an orphan with no one searching for him, Kingston accepted his fate, seeing the military as a source of food, shelter, and new skills, though it would transform him in ways he never anticipated. By 14, Kingston had become a professional marksman with knowledge of explosives, ambushes, and a mindset of hypervigilance that would stay with him forever. After witnessing his best friend's murder at gunpoint, a traumatic event that pushed him over the edge, Kingston went on a violent rampage that forced him to flee Honduras at 14. He migrated through Guatemala and Mexico before crossing into Texas, eventually making his way to New York, where a half-brother helped him secure a green card. Though briefly working legitimately painting cars, Kingston quickly returned to gang life with the Bloods in the Bronx. His military training and hardened demeanor earned him leadership over dozens of young gang members. Kingston spent nearly a decade in various New York prisons, finding structure in gang life, but eventually losing hope during years in isolation. Unexpectedly, letters he had written to Albany with help from another inmate resulted in his release and deportation to Honduras, where someone attempted to kill him shortly after his return, prompting his escape to Mexico and eventual work as a migrant smuggler. As we drive through Chiapas, Kingston and I stop to help struggling migrants, with Kingston offering them marijuana, cigarettes, advice about checkpoints, and a cold beer. Kingston reflects on possibly starting a shelter for migrants where people could rest and even party as long as they kept things under control. Kingston shares his decade of experience smuggling people through Mexico, describing the financial challenges, the emotional highs and lows, and the substantial cash required for bribes and transportation. He explains that guides need to charge at least $1,000 per person because expenses often reach $500 before even leaving Guatemala. As violence against migrants increased around 2007, Kingston declared war on gangs attacking migrants, especially Garifuna people. He began traveling with armed soldiers, like the quiet but dangerous priest. Kingston explains that about 90% of guides are gang-affiliated because connections are essential for protection. The chapter opens with Chino and Jesmine looking haggard after days on the train tracks. Chino is feverish and injured, showing a purple bruise with an infected puncture wound from being thrown off a train. Despite his injury, Chino appears unusually calm and cheerful as the group sits by the tracks in Pacalna. Chino contemplates a different kind of life in Mexico with Jesmine, discussing possibilities of renting a room together or finding work in Guatemala through Jesmine's mother's connections. After weeks of mounting tension, Bin Laden and the Breadman lure Chino to a secluded area along the train tracks outside Pakalna, insisting they need to talk privately despite Jesmond's attempts to keep the conversation in public. When the group reaches a known robbery spot, the confrontation escalates until Bin Laden suddenly stabs Chino in the chest, puncturing his lung and nearly his heart. Jesmond watches in horror, frozen with fear, while the Guatemalans who accompanied them flee. After Chino's stabbing, Jesmond finds herself alone at the hospital with him for 9 days. The nurses treat his punctured lung and provide care while kindly allowing her to stay in his room. Despite his injuries, Chino maintains his humor, joking about wearing diapers and making nurses laugh. From his hospital bed, Chino has an epiphany that Jesmond is his savior rather than the other way around, telling her, "I thank God for putting you in my life." Their path forward materializes when a handcuffed Honduran prisoner gives Jesmond 500 lempiras after hearing their story, a sign from God that they should return home. 48 hours later, they're on a southbound bus with Chino bandaged but smiling in new clothes. At a bus terminal, they encounter a Honduran woman and child heading north. Chino warns them about the dangers ahead while gently reassuring the child. Despite his ordeal, Chino chooses forgiveness over revenge, telling Jesmond, "I want to erase everything and begin again." After 3 days of bus travel from Palenque, Chino and Jesmond arrive at his sister Marina's home in Honduras. Though initially appearing changed and hopeful about starting a new life with Jesmond, Chino's knife wounds worsen until he admits needing medical help. At the public hospital, they encounter a nightmare of indifference and financial barriers, having to carry him up 3 flights of stairs, rent a breathing machine for $100, and source 7 pints of blood before doctors would operate. While awaiting surgery, Jesmond reads him Psalm 91 and they discuss their plans for a new life together. Chino promises to change his ways and attend church, but grows anxious whenever Jesmond leaves his side, revealing his deep fear of abandonment stemming from childhood. Despite doctors' contradictory assessments, Chino's condition deteriorates as his lungs fill with fluid. After 4 days, he finally receives surgery for his punctured lung, briefly improving before his condition rapidly deteriorates when fluid moves to his other lung. Without $2,000 for a breathing machine and with only manual ventilation available, Chino dies on August 21 at 9 o'clock, surrounded by Marina and Jesmond. At Chino's wake, his body rests in a cracked glass-windowed coffin, dressed in white and black, his face bearing a slight grin despite the embalming fluid staining his clothes. Marina supports her frail mother while containing her own grief, and Jesmond finally releases the tears she'd been holding back. His grandfather Innocente, typically stoic, breaks down and sits with him all night. Chino's wild friends arrive with alcohol and shovels, performing a familiar mourning ritual of drunken grief that Chino himself had enacted many times before. After presenting Chino's story to an academic audience, I faced challenging questions about why we should care about smugglers who do horrible things. Rather than offering simple answers or redemption narratives, I emphasize that human smuggling is a brutal social process affecting countless people worldwide. Chino was just one person caught in something much larger than himself, a global migration crisis that continues to claim lives. I refuse to simplify this reality for academic consumption, noting that while smugglers may be unlikable, if not outright detestable, our ire should also be directed at the larger forces creating violent systems of clandestine movement. Global inequality keeps people like Chino in business. Border walls and security measures only fuel the smuggling industry rather than addressing the economic, political, and environmental roots of migration. Wherever borders separate haves from have-nots, desperate people and enterprising smugglers will always find ways through. Flaco has essentially retired from the smuggling business, now living in Tapachula with his teenage Honduran wife and 3-week-old baby girl. Despite his struggles, being evicted right after his daughter's birth and now sleeping on concrete floors, he maintains hope. He works clearing land for construction and occasionally helps people from Honduras reach Mexico, earning just enough to survive. Flaco dreams of building a small home on unclaimed riverfront land where squatters can establish residence without paying rent. He envisions a simple house costing around $1,500 with fruit trees and access to clean well water, a refuge away from the train tracks, violence, and ghosts of his past. As we talk by the river at sunset, news arrives of a horrific accident. A tractor-trailer carrying over 100 migrants has crashed in Chiapas, killing 54 people. Flaco simply shakes his head and says, "It's only getting worse." The monster of migration continues to consume lives, those of migrants and smugglers alike. Santos avoids cartel recruitment, recognizing the dangers from his past experiences. When his brother Marvin is severely burned in an explosion during cartel work, Santos is permitted to visit his dying brother, unwittingly becoming trapped at a cartel-controlled mountain farm for 6 months. After his release, Santos commits to manual labor in the punishing Sonoran heat rather than attempting to cross into the United States again, finding contentment in honest work moving cinder blocks rather than carrying marijuana bales on his back. While Santos has built a precarious but honest life in Mexicali, his brother Marvin took a different path. After Santos escaped the cartel, Marvin returned to criminal life and now celebrates his birthday behind bars, serving at least 20 years in Mexico for murder. As Santos dances to Fanatica Sensual in his dilapidated house near the border, there's a moment of joy and hope, though tempered by weariness. A brief respite from what Santos once described as dancing to the devil's gunfire. You have to keep dancing as long as those bullets are flying, because once you stop, he puts a slug in your chest.